1 Corinthians 3:1 through 3:15, the third talk in a series titled Reading the Book, Lessons in Understanding the Bible, was presented by Ron Julian on April 17, 2001, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
We're continuing in our series on approaches to reading the Bible. We've called it Reading the Book. Just to give you a little background here on what it is we're trying to do, in some classes on how to be a good student of the Bible, we might take a very systematic approach and show you how to use a concordance and how to do word studies and things like that. Those are all very good things to do. I have nothing against that. That's a great thing to do. But what we're trying to do in this class is more give you a feel for the difference between an interpretation of a passage that has paid careful attention to what's going on in the text and one that hasn't. So we're picking particular passages that we think illustrate certain points pretty well. The first week, we've been in 1 Corinthians, and the first week I tried to illustrate for you the importance of becoming familiar with the background to a letter, to understand what the basic issues are that the author is actually addressing, what is the situation into which he's writing, and so on. In the second week, I talked some about making sure that I understand who and what it is that the author is talking about. In particular, we focused on the use of the word "we," and the mistake that we can sometimes make in assuming that when a biblical author says "we," he means all Christians, and that I can take that as some sort of a promise or something like that from my own experience. Sometimes it is, but I have to be careful that I'm actually paying attention to what the author is saying to the particular people that he's writing to. I will acknowledge that last week the passage we looked at was somewhat difficult. I think the point that we need to pay attention as to who the "we" is and who's being talked about in a passage is an easy one to understand. The passage that we talked about is a particularly difficult one to understand, I think. And I will fess up to that. That was not the easiest discussion to follow, probably. Today, we're talking about a passage. Before I say anything about it, let me read you that statement that I had you take away last time to think about if you wanted to. You know, no pressure, you could do what you wanted. But the statement said this: Christians should take great care to live in such a way that they not lose their heavenly rewards. As Paul warns in 1 Corinthians 3:11 through 15, we must build on the foundation of our faith with good works rather than worthless, faithless works. If we live our lives building with gold, silver, precious stones, that is, good works, then we will receive rewards in heaven on the day of judgment. If we live our lives building with wood, hay, and straw, that is, worldly and evil works, then we will still be saved, but we will lose our eternal rewards. Okay. Now, there's the statement that I wanted you to think about. It's probably not all that surprising to you. You might sort of start to notice a pattern as we go along, that the passage, the little thing that I have you read, you just might want to think about the possibility that there's another different way of thinking about it than the one that I'm showing you. I hope I'm not giving away too much. But this passage is one that we have been using to illustrate the kind of point that we're talking about tonight for years and years. I mean, it goes back at least 25 years in my history, because it's a very handy passage. It's pretty clean. It's not entirely clean, but it's pretty clean. A very handy passage to illustrate the importance of reading in context and following an author's argument in context. This passage is very, very, very commonly used, pulling it out of context and saying, here, you want to know about your rewards? Look what Paul has to say. You've got to build on the foundation of your faith with gold and silver and precious stones, and that's how you're going to get your reward. And if you don't do that, if you build with poor materials, then you will be saved as though through fire. You will still be saved, but you won't receive rewards. I had the uncomfortable position when at the church that I used to teach at years and years ago in California of, you know, being involved in teaching classes about how to study the Bible and looking at this passage as one of them, but then being in the Bible study, being led by one of the pastors there in the church, and the pastor saying, now here's, this is a very important passage because it shows us how we can lose our rewards, and we've got to make sure that we build on our faith with good works and do good works or we won't get our rewards. And so it's not a straw man that I'm constructing here. It's not, I didn't make this up, and there's nobody in the world that believes this. I have heard this many, many times. But I would argue that it's not actually all that hard to see that this is not what this passage is talking about if we go and follow it through. The key, however, is, as I've been saying, why is it, if it's relatively easy to see, why is it that more of us don't see it? Well, it's because we don't really pay any attention to the context when we go and look at something like this. If you were interested in the subject of rewards, somebody would tell you one of the key passages on rewards is found in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verses 10 or 11 through 15. And so you would go and you would jump in at verse 10 or verse 11 and start reading it there. You were told that it was about rewards. You would read it and say, yeah, I can see how that's about rewards, and you would go away having never really ever wrestled with the question of what is Paul talking about? What's the topic? What is he getting at here? And frankly, as I've kind of warned you along the way, one of the lessons that I'm trying to get across in this class, if we're going to be good students of the Bible, is that we have to let the Bible tell its own story. When we go to the passage and say, I want to know all about rewards, tell me about rewards, the problem is that I'm not being patient enough to stop and listen to Paul and have him tell me what is it that he's talking about. I may have a question about rewards, but he may be answering another question entirely. And that's that sort of patience, that sort of coming to the text and saying, I know that all these people lived a long time ago, but the only way I'm going to know what Paul's talking about is to sit and carefully follow what is he saying to the Corinthians about the situation in which they find themselves. That's the only way that I'm really going to be able to come away and understand how Paul looks at things. I don't know if you've ever had the experience, but if anybody once decides that they want to misrepresent you and take your letters and have you say things that you didn't mean, it's not all that hard to do. I mean, just start asking different questions than the ones that you set out to talk about, and then pull things out of what you said and say, see what this person said? It's not hard. It can be done with anything. So, what I'd like to do tonight is look at this passage because, as I say, it's a very good example of how you can go wrong if you don't pay attention to the particular context, the particular flow of thought in the passage that you're dealing with. Okay, we're in chapter 3 of 1 Corinthians. We're going to be concerned especially with the verses like 11 and 12, but we don't want to start there. We need to back up here. I'm going to start reading at the beginning, but some of the details here we're going to let slip because there are particular things I want to emphasize. He says, "And I, brethren, could not speak to you as to spiritual men, but as to men of flesh, as to babes in Christ. I gave you milk to drink, not solid food, for you are not yet able to receive it. Indeed, even now you are not yet able, for you are still fleshly. For since there is jealousy and strife among you, are you not fleshly, and are you not walking like mere men? For when one says, I am of Paul, and another, I am of Apollos, are you not mere men? Okay, so I'd like to point out here, in verse 4, we're starting to turn towards the particular thing that Paul wants to talk about in this section. We've seen already, if you've been here in the earlier classes, in 1 Corinthians, there is this underlying issue in the first several chapters. People in the church have been dividing up, not just sort of my favorite teacher is Paul and my favorite teacher is Apollos, but actual factions where there are people in Corinth who would reject Paul as an apostle altogether. Yes, he founded the church, but we have decided that we're really not interested in what Paul has to say. We really like Apollos. And we've talked about how Apollos was a very eloquent speaker, and especially in the Greek thinking of the time, an impressive, wise speaker would have been the sort of person like Apollos, the one who was eloquent, the one who was good at debating, the one who was good at mowing down the opposition. That would have been very impressive to them. And evidently, there are those who are saying, we know that we see in 2 Corinthians, that there are those who are saying that Paul is unimpressive in his speech and questioning whether he really ought to be considered an apostle at all. So there is this real problem that people are choosing up sides, and some of them, in their worldliness, have chosen Apollos over Paul. Not necessarily that Apollos set himself up for that. The evidence seems to suggest that he didn't seek to put himself in that spot, but whether he did or not, he ended up there. And there are actually those who would pit Apollos against Paul, say, we'll listen to Apollos, we follow him, but we're not interested in what Paul says. And then others in reaction to that are saying, no, we're with Paul, we don't want to have anything to do with Apollos. And presumably all kinds of things like that are going on. So, when one says, I am of Paul, and another, I am of Apollos, are you not mere men? Is there anything spiritual about that perspective, he's saying? What then is Apollos? And what is Paul? Servants through whom you believed, even as the Lord gave opportunity to each one. So the question he's asking here is, how should you be thinking about us? If you want to ask the question, who is Apollos and who is Paul, what answer ought you to be giving to this? They are servants through whom you believed. I preached the gospel, and you heard it and believed it. Apollos came afterwards and added to the work that I had done, and there was a further impact from his ministry. We are servants of God. Servants serving you so that you might come to believe the gospel. Remember the background to this. We talked about this in the first week. Paul founded the church in Corinth. He was there for a year and a half, and then he left. And when he went out, Apollos, new convert, eloquent, fiery speaker, he comes in. So Paul is gone, and now Apollos has come in his place. Both of them, he's saying, you ought to think of us merely as servants. Now, Paul says, I planted, Apollos watered, but God was causing the growth. Hopefully we can see here that there is a metaphor that Paul is starting to explore here. I planted and Apollos watered. Can you see in that picture, Paul is saying that he planted because he's the one who founded the church. He started it. He came and preached the gospel first. It's like sowing the seeds initially. Apollos comes along afterwards. He didn't plant the seeds. The church had been in existence for a year and a half. At least Paul had been there for a year and a half preaching. Apollos comes in afterwards, but he's continuing to teach and encourage the believers in Corinth. So, Paul planted the seeds, Apollos is watering them, but God caused the growth. Neither Paul nor Apollos can take credit for the impact that their ministry had on the Corinthians. The fact that there were Corinthians who believed, who actually truly did believe, entered into eternal life, were transformed by the work of the Spirit of God and so on. That's not Paul's doing. He's a servant, just as Apollos is a servant. They had their role. God gave them something to do. Paul started it. Apollos comes along and adds to what Paul has been doing. He's watering the seeds that Paul planted. But neither one of them is responsible for the growth. Just like, in that analogy, you could think of the farmer, one guy plants the seeds and another one waters. Neither one of them can really take credit for the fact that a crop grows up. This is God's work. This is the way God has made the world. I can't create a seed that grows into a plant. But I can go out and sow the seed and I can water it, and then the growth that is caused by God can happen. So then, neither the one who plants nor the one who waters is anything but God who causes the growth. He wants to emphasize here. You guys are making such a big deal about who's the head guy, who's the guy we ought to be listening to. Well, the fact is we're just servants. Neither one of us is any big deal. You shouldn't be making a big deal of me, and you shouldn't be making a big deal of Apollos. God is the one who is at work here. What you ought to be emphasizing is the work that God is doing. We are just servants of the God who is at work among you. Now, he has a comment to make here. Now, he who plants and he who waters are one, but each will receive his own reward according to his own labor. Okay, Paul stops and makes this comment. The one who plants and the one who waters are one. And I think what he means by that is the fact that I planted and that Apollos watered, both of us are just servants. We are equal in importance in the sense that we are both servants of God. We're one in that. We are equals in the sense of how important are we as individuals. We are both servants. That's what's important about us. But is there something individual about us as well? Yes, there is something individual. I and Apollos, each of us is going to receive our reward according to his own labor. That is, now, let me make a comment here. When he says reward here, I think we would do better to translate it wage, which is what the word typically would mean. Many places in the Bible when we see about a worker receiving his wage, this is the word that would be used. We're in the middle of a metaphor here. Paul and Apollos are workers. They're servants. Paul is a planter and Apollos is a waterer. And they're no big deal in and of themselves. They're the same in their importance in that they're servants of God. But there is a difference. Each of them is going to receive his own wage. We may be one in that we're both servants, but we don't get paid at the end as a group. We get our own individual pay. I'm going to receive my wage for the work that I did, and Apollos is going to receive his wage for the work that he did. Each of us is going to be, in other words, what he's saying is, according to his own labor, according to the quality of our labor, we're going to get our wage. Now, he doesn't say what this wage is or what kind of thing he's talking about, but what he's trying to get across to them here is we're just servants, but there is a difference between us in that there is this assessment that is going to be made of our work. What kind of work did we do? I was planting, Apollos was watering. Each of us is going to, in other words, each of us is going to answer in the end for our own work. I'm going to answer for what I did, and Apollos is going to answer for what he did. 4, we are God's fellow workers. You are God's field, God's building. Okay, now, we, who is we in this case? This is Paul and Apollos. We are God's fellow workers. I planted, Apollos watered, but we're just co-laborers in the field. You, the Corinthian church, are God's field. We're the laborers in the field, and you're the field. Each of us, I, Paul, and Apollos, we're going to receive our wage. We're going to answer in the end for what we have done as workers in the field. We are the workers working together in your church among you, and you are the field. So if we were to sort of take stock of what we've got up to this point, we've got Paul making a metaphor. The Corinthian church is a field. Paul was the guy who planted the seeds in the field. Apollos came along and watered the seeds in the field. And each of them is going to receive his wage based on the work that he did in the field that is the Corinthians. All right? Now, verse 9 is absolutely essential for the passage that we're trying to understand. We're about, you can see, we're creeping up on it here. We're about to get to the passage that everybody quotes about building on the foundation with wood, hay, and stubble, and so on. Verse 9 is crucial. For we are God's fellow workers, you are God's field, God's building. We have now switched. We had a metaphor about a field, and now we're going to switch to a metaphor about a building. Okay, at this point, we're talking about a field, now we're talking about a building, but the same issue is being discussed. You are God's building. Who is you? That's you, the Corinthian church that he's writing to. You're the field in which I planted and Apollos watered. You're the building. Now, what happened at this building? In verse 10, according to the grace of God, which was given to me as a wise master builder, I laid a foundation, and another is building upon it. Okay? We should, if we have been paying attention as we come along here, it ought to be pretty clear what Paul has just done. He was talking about how he planted the seed and Apollos watered it. Now he's saying, I laid the foundation, and another is building upon it. Well, we're in the same territory. Paul is the first guy. If we're talking about a building, he laid the foundation. If we're talking about a field, he planted the seed. Apollos is the second guy. If we're talking about the field, he watered the seeds. If we're talking about the building, he built on the foundation that Paul laid down. So this right here ought to be sending, warning bells ought to be going off. If we're thinking about how we typically might hear this passage taught, the idea of building on the foundation, the way I have been taught it and heard it taught many times, is this is a picture of the foundation is my faith in Jesus, and building on the foundation is adding good works, doing good works in addition to my faith. The foundation has been laid, which is my faith, and then I add to that by doing good works. But if we're following this, you can see the issue has nothing to do with me doing good works in addition to my faith. The issue is Apollos, and perhaps others, as we'll see, is adding to the work that Paul did. Paul laid the foundation. He was there for a year and a half. He preached the gospel. He left, and then others come along and are working on it. But let each man be careful how he builds upon it. Now this is his warning. Look, you guys, I was there. I was a wise master builder. Notice this is actually a very strong claim that he's making. When he says each of us is going to receive our wage for our work, let me tell you what kind of work I did. I was a wise master builder. I'm the kind of guy you want to have laying the foundation of the building because I know what I'm doing. The foundation that I laid was a good foundation. It was a strong foundation. This building ought to be a great building because the foundation that was laid is a great foundation. But now I'm gone, and I'm hearing about people building on this foundation that I laid, and I just want to give you a warning. You had better be careful how you build on this foundation that I laid. Here I am gone, and I'm hearing about this weird stuff. I mean, people are they're pursuing worldly things. They don't seem to be in sync with the gospel that I proclaimed when I was there. Let each man be careful how he builds upon it, for no man can lay a foundation other than the one which is laid, which is Jesus Christ. Okay, that's the foundation that he laid. Just like what he said in chapter 2, where he says, I determined to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. He's saying, that's what I did. When I was there, I preached the gospel. I told you who Jesus was and how he died on the cross and what the significance of the cross is and why you ought to believe that he's the Messiah and that. That was my message. That's what I preached. And that was a good message. That's what he keeps saying. Chapter 1 and chapter 2, he's been saying, the message that I preached when I was there is true wisdom. This is, you can't get any better than what I preached. I mean, it is the truth. And it is fundamental. I mean, this is the truth of truths. This is the good stuff. That's the kind of foundation that I laid. Now, if any man builds upon the foundation with gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, straw, each man's work will become evident, for the day will show it, because it is to be revealed with fire. And the fire itself will test the quality of each man's work. If any man's work which he has built upon it remains, he shall receive a reward. If any man's work is burned up, he shall suffer loss. But he himself shall be saved, yet as though through fire. Okay, now that's the passage we're concerned with, but let me point out a couple of things here. Notice that this is not the first time that we've seen him talking about somebody's work being evaluated and their wage coming to them for their work. That's what he said back when he was talking about himself and Apollos as workers in God's field. Each of us is going to receive our wage according to our work. Well, here again, he's warning them. The work that you have done, I feel confident. I'm a wise master builder. I laid a good foundation. But you who are coming along and building on the foundation that I laid, you had better take care. You had better think about what you're doing here, because there is a day coming that is going to test the quality of each man's work. What kind of work are we talking about here? Well, we're talking about the work of someone like Apollos and others in Corinth who have presumed to set themselves up as teachers. And these ones I'm thinking of in particular are the ones we know that are in opposition to Paul. Apollos, he seems to have maybe made some mistakes along the way about how he handled the situation. There are others in Corinth, though, who didn't just make mistakes. They are out-and-out opponents of the gospel that Paul preaches. So what's happened here, I think, is, in his first analogy, he's just going through and saying, you know, I planted, Apollos watered, and each of us is going to receive our wage according to our work. This time, he says, let each man be careful how he builds upon it, because he's expanding the picture a little bit, because he knows that it's not just Apollos who came along and built on the foundation that he laid in Corinth, but actually a number of people have been building on that foundation. And some of them have been building with pretty rotten materials. They have actually been seeking to undo what it is that Paul was doing there. Okay, now, there are two directions we can go here. There are some details that we will want to talk about what exactly is he getting at. What sort of a wage is he talking about? What does it mean for the work to be burnt up? And we want to talk about that in a second. But I want to stop before we get there. Before we answer those questions, what needs to be clear to us is that the topic in this section is something very different than we make it if we come to this passage and say, oh, this is the big passage that talks about how you get rewards in heaven for your good works. It's not. Whatever it is that we conclude that Paul is saying about the wage that he's going to get and Apollos is going to get for their work. This is not a passage that talks about how Christians get rewards for good works. This is a passage of warning where Paul is saying, ultimately, you guys who are presuming to teach, presuming to build on the work that I did there in Corinth, had better think about what you're doing. Because just as I am going to be answerable, ultimately, for what I did in teaching there, you're going to be answerable as well. And if you're undoing the work that I've done there, if in the end the building doesn't survive, you're going to really have to answer for that. That's the issue. That's what this passage is about. So if there's a warning that we want to take to heart here, we need to start by recognizing the warning has to do with not, oh, I had better make sure that I do good works or I won't get rewards, but rather, I had better pay attention. If I'm going to presume to teach somebody else, I had better pay attention that I am building with the same kind of materials that the wise master builder was working with. In other words, that I am preaching the gospel that Paul preached rather than undermining it with something else. That's what this passage is concerned with. Now, I don't have... Okay, before I go there, let me show you my charts that I gave you here. What I'm trying to demonstrate is, in the first chart, we have these two metaphors. The Corinthians are God's field. The Corinthian church is God's building. Paul and Apollos are field workers in the field. They are builders of God's building. Paul planted the field. God laid the foundation of the building. Apollos watered the field. Apollos built upon the foundation of the building. Paul and Apollos are going to receive their wage for what they did as workers in the field, and each man had better be careful how he builds upon the foundation that Paul laid. There is this parallelism through the whole thing. Both of them are talking about the same thing. So, my basic point about this passage can be summed up in that last little chart. The metaphor of a builder does not mean each believer, but it means Apollos and others who happened to presume to teach in Corinth after Paul left. When it talks about a building, that doesn't mean in my own life, my life is a building that I'm constructing and I'm using good works or poor works in this building. The building is the Corinthian church. Building on a foundation does not mean adding to my faith, it means adding to Paul's teaching there in Corinth. Building with precious stones is not talking about good works, it's talking about the wise, in keeping with the gospel sort of teaching that ought to be happening, or the worthless stuff that's going to be burned in the end is not talking about evil works that I'm doing in my life, it's talking about foolish, worldly teaching that is undermining what Paul has taught there in Corinth. That's what this passage is about. Now, we come to the question about what is Paul's conception of this wage that he's going to get and that others are going to get for the work that they did. It's not so easy a question to answer. I don't have a real firm, dogmatic sort of answer to that question at this point. There are a couple of things that strike me that can help us kind of pin it down. First of all, we see this picture of, the question is whether the building survives the fire. Well, what's the building? The building is the Corinthian church. So this fire that's going to test the building ultimately is, it's going to test whether this community of believers is going to hold up as a community of believers. I mean, what's being tested is, I think it has to be emphasizing somehow ultimately, what did you accomplish there? What were you doing? You know, if I were to start preaching here a message, I don't know, and just make something up, something that everybody particular part of our culture would really like to hear. You know, how you can get rich, or, you know, how God really wants us to have group orgies, or whatever it might be. I could proclaim some message here, and many of you would stop coming to this class, but I could find others probably who would come, because they kind of like what it is I have to say. And the whole tenor of the community of people would change based on the sort of thing that's being taught, the sort of thing that is being proclaimed as the truth. Well, in the end, though, the question is it going to survive when the day tests it? It's like a fire that runs through. All of the shoddy materials are going to be burnt away, and we're going to find out with what's left. Well, in Corinth, what would have been left is the foundation would have been left that Paul proclaimed. That was solid enough. But what were people doing on top of that? So the picture of this judgment that's coming through is not an evaluation of my life, but it's an evaluation of the Corinthian church. What sort of work did Apollos and others do? Did they foster and strengthen and encourage those who have a genuine faith in Christ to hold fast to that faith and gather together and be committed to that faith? Or did they encourage something that was worldly and a message that had very little to do with the gospel and in the end attracted people for very different reasons? What's the quality of the work that they had? In the end, they're going to receive a wage for what they did. Well, is it possible that this wage has something to do with our concept of heavenly rewards? Yeah, it's possible. Maybe the issue is, you know, how much responsibility are you going to have in the kingdom of God? I can't rule that out as a possibility just on this passage alone. We would have to talk about other passages to try to put that whole picture together. But I will point out that that's not the only way that we could understand what's happening here, because Paul, in other places, uses language like how he is looking forward to the day when he stands before Christ and those that he has encouraged in the faith stand with him. He talks about them as his joy and his crown. Because these people who could stand with him and say, Paul told us the truth, he encouraged us to believe the gospel, he was an encouragement to us. He pointed us in the right direction. We're grateful to him for the guidance and the wisdom that he gave us. They're going to stand there, and to Paul, there's something very satisfying about their testimony to his faithfulness. He calls them his crown. It's like the fact that I had the opportunity to faithfully proclaim the gospel and that these people could say he did that, that meant something to him. So it's quite possible that the picture that he's painting here of the reward, the wage that comes, and the loss that happens if the fire goes through and the building doesn't stand, I mean, what happens in that situation is you look at the work that you did, the years you spent teaching among these people, and recognize that you were wasting your time, that you were telling them foolish, stupid things that they foolishly listened to, and it didn't get anybody anywhere. That in and of itself is a sobering sort of thing. Why does he add the part that he himself will be saved, yet as though through fire? It's hard to be dogmatic about it, but I think that he puts that in there because, after all, he has sort of tactfully dropped Apollos' name out of the discussion at this point. Earlier, it was clear that Apollos is the guy who came along and added to what he did. Now he's saying, let each man be careful how he builds. And there are others other than Apollos. But the fact is that there is a certain sort of implication in what Paul's saying that he has not denied, that perhaps Apollos may have some things to regret about how he conducted himself when he was there. Not that he was an opponent of the gospel and an enemy of Paul who was trying to undo what Paul did, but the fact is he ended up in a situation where a significant number of the people in the church picked him as their leader and said, "We hate Paul, we want you." And somehow in this situation, Apollos, he certainly didn't nip it in the bud. He didn't put it to rest because it's still going on. Like I say, it's hard to say for sure, but I'm very tempted to think at the end when Paul talks about how he wants to send Apollos back to him, but he doesn't want to come right now. I think it's very reasonable. Many people have read that and thought, you know, it's not unlikely that the reason that Apollos doesn't want to go back at this point is that he's embarrassed at what happened. He's just unhappy at the impact of what it is. He wanted to go in and be helpful, and he was helpful up to a point, but he also managed to foster a significant problem. And in the end, he's perhaps thinking, well, I just don't know if I want to go back there right now. Now, that's speculation on my part. That may not be the case, but it would make sense if it were. But what I'm saying here is that since Paul is sort of implying that Apollos is the guy, he's one of those who's built, let everybody be careful how they build, that he himself will be saved yet as through fire, may be a kind of a gracious way for Paul to indicate, I'm not saying that because somebody screws up and the work that they did ends up not standing up to the test of time, I'm not saying that that automatically disqualifies you. I'm not saying that Apollos is doomed because it turned out this way. But the fact is, we've got to be careful. You have to keep in mind, the next time Apollos goes into a situation like this, he needs to keep in mind, what is my goal? What are we trying to accomplish here? In the end, what we're trying to accomplish is to encourage people to hold fast to the apostolic gospel, the message that Paul and the other apostles preached, to hold to it, to believe it, to let it inform the way we think and live and change our perspective on life. That's what the goal is. And maybe being a powerful debater and decimating the Jews in debates and stuff like that may be interesting, but secondary in importance to making sure that the community of people are being pointed to the good stuff and being centered in that. Okay, that part's a little harder to say. I sort of find myself leaning right now in the direction of thinking that the picture he has of the wage, remember it's a metaphor, it's your pay for the work you did as a builder of the building. I'm inclined to think that he has more in mind in the end. Will I be able to look at it and receive the satisfaction of having been faithful in my work and seeing the result of that or not? But it is possible that Paul has in mind that there is some benefit to be gained in being a faithful proponent of the gospel. Can't answer that from this passage. We would have to go to other passages. Now, I don't mind telling you that when I put the biblical picture together, I have a really different picture myself of the concept of rewards than the one that you often hear. But my purpose tonight isn't to preach a sermon on rewards. I just want us to see that in this particular context, if we follow the argument through, we can see what it is that Paul has on his mind. And what he has on his mind is different than what you often hear people say. The question that he has on his mind is, what is Apollos and some of you other guys maybe, what are you guys doing when you're coming and teaching there in Corinth after I did? That's the issue. Can we derive an understanding of things from this? Yes, we can. Is there something that we can apply to ourselves? Yeah. But it's not so much, oh, I had better make sure that I do some good works so I'll get rewards, but rather, I had better take care that I am following the true gospel, and that when I'm talking to other people, that I'm not messing with what Paul said, but that I'm giving them the straight stuff. That's the message, that's the warning that I'm supposed to take away from this. Okay, well, that's what I wanted to say. And especially since I have a cold and I'm feeling a little woozy, I don't feel at all bad about just stopping talking there. Now, I'd like to give you an opportunity, though, to ask any questions or make any comments that you might have. Why am I not surprised that you...
What is a group orgy and how much does it cost?
Yeah, well, we haven't really hit on the price yet.
Boy, if this came down from Washington to answer that question. really good putting it in the context of First Corinthians 4, rather than, I realize that it really was. However, I got a nitpick.
Right.
And Ephesians, in the metaphor in the body, the Spirit causes the growth through the teachers of different types, through that which every joint supplies. And with this metaphor of a builder being in the context of the first four chapters, where he's contrasting worldly wisdom with the gospel, the simple gospel of Christ, would it not be better to take Paul's statement, let each man be careful how he builds, and saying that we all, whether we speak or whether we serve with our gifts, we all better make sure it's done in the humility of Christ for the agape of God, rather than for egocentric reasons, whether it be pride in my knowledge, or pride in my service, or pride in my sensitivity to spirits, etc., etc. So, in that case, the builder metaphor, when he does speak in this passage, does speak to each individual believer.
Okay, yeah, I see what you're saying. It's possible. Let me grant for a minute, let's suppose what you're saying is true. I'm not sure that it is, but let me... For the sake of argument, let's say it was. What we would be saying is, what I'm denying in my chart here is that the metaphor is each believer in his own life adds to his own faith, that whole progression of things. What you would be saying is each believer should be taking care of the impact of their own ministry, life, and work on the community of people
and
that they're in.
Building on Christ, not destroying them with ego.
Right. So, yeah, that would be an adjustment of what I'm saying, but the basic idea would be the same. That is, the issue is, what for Paul, the issue is, what are you guys doing there in Corinth to this message that I preached? I preached this message, and then there's all of this stuff going on. What's happening there? Now, given the fact that he starts out talking about himself and Apollos, distinguishing we're the workers and you guys are the field, I'm still inclined to think that he has in mind here the distinction between those whose primary purpose, or who at least have a significant role in teaching and ministering to the church. They, in particular, are the ones who need to take care.
It is the message that is the focal point of all four.
Right. I mean, I certainly don't disagree with you that we all have our role to play, and we all need to take care in the way that he's describing here. I think, though, in this context, he's particularly concerned about the fact that these divisions have come up where different people, Apollos has been set against Paul, and the kind of the ringleaders in the factions that he's talking about. Because he's going to go on to say, I didn't talk about this, but when he says, "Do you not know that you are a temple of God and that the Spirit of God dwells in you? If any man destroys the temple of God, God will destroy him, for the temple of God is holy, and that is what you are." We make a mistake oftentimes in this passage because we know that sometimes our bodies are referred to as a temple or so on, that says, well, you shouldn't destroy the temple of God, so we shouldn't smoke and that kind of thing. But that's not at all what Paul's getting at. He's talking about the Corinthian church as the dwelling place of the Holy Spirit, the temple of God. And if someone were to come along and destroy that, I mean, not just like Apollos kind of mess up and maybe contribute to some factionalism, but to actually set out to undo what it is that Paul has done, to call people away from the gospel into something else, to actually destroy the work that Paul has been doing there, he says, God will destroy you. You had better take care. So I think he has primarily in mind, it's not so much a warning to every believer to take care about our attitudes, although he certainly does talk about that at times, but he's in particular concerned about those who are seeking to have an impact on the church, I think, and he's warning them, you know, each of us is going to have to answer for what we did, and if you have destroyed God's temple, then he will destroy you. I mean, this is, you know, this is a no uncertain... Pardon me?
I can't argue with that.
Right. Okay, so, anything else? I know you're all just being nice because I said I was feeling woozy. I said, have pity on the poor guy, let him go home. No, I can stand here a few more minutes.
Could you tell us a little bit more about us being the temple, the Holy Spirit, or the Church of Corinthians? This just what you just said, could you just explain a little bit more what you mean and how we usually hear and, yeah.
Right. Well, see, I think that it's not that the Bible has one picture of what it means to be the temple of God, but it's a different one depending on the truth that's being emphasized. You could argue, say, in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, where he's talking about avoiding sexual immorality. He says in 19, "Or do you not know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit who is in you, whom you have from God, and that you are not your own? For you have been bought with a price, therefore glorify God in your body." There, the picture of that he has in mind is, it all comes back to the idea of the temple. We don't have the experience that they would have had, the concept of what a temple was. And we don't think about it in these terms. But if you think about in Israel's history, you know, you're going along and following the Shekinah glory through the desert, and then when you come to stop, that glory sort of rests over this place, and it comes about that you make this tent, and there's the holy place inside, and every now and again Moses would go in there and talk with God, and he'd come out and his face would be glowing. There's this concept that the temple is the place where God is. Not that they didn't understand that God was bigger. I mean, it's not like he had a body and he was right in that spot, but there's this sense in which this is God's dwelling place. You know, this is God's house. For our sake, I mean, we look at it in a unique and special way. Well, in the New Testament, what they're trying to get across to us is, if you think about that uniqueness of that, this is the place where God is, well, me personally, as a believer, the Spirit of God is at work in me. The Spirit of God is transforming me. He is doing His work. So there's a profound sense in which you can say, I am the temple of God. I am the place where the glory of God comes to rest and dwell. Because, as Paul talks about in 2 Corinthians, he paints that picture of, it's like all of us going into the holy place and lifting the veil and seeing the glory of God and being transformed into that. So So there is a sense in which I personally can be seen. My body is a temple of God. If you want to know where God is, where can you find God at work? You can find Him at work in here. And that's a profound thing. But that's not the only picture. And more often, I think the picture is painted of the temple of God as being the community of people. God is at work among us. Not just in me, but in us. And so, Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, I think, is emphasizing, look, this is not, I didn't come and build an Odd Fellows Hall or something like that. I mean, this is not like I came and founded an Elks Club or something where let's all get together and have fun on Friday nights or something like that. I came and preached the gospel, and the Spirit of God is at work in the lives of individuals, bringing them to an understanding of the truth, cleansing their souls, bringing them into eternal life, and so on. This is a place where God is at work. Now, then, this place where God is at work, if there are people among you who are seeking to undo, to destroy this thing that I have done, they would like to take this and turn it into something else. They don't like the message that Paul's preaching. They want it to be a different one. They'll still have Jesus attached to it, but they want it to be a different message, a message that the world will appreciate and find wise and sophisticated. If they were to destroy the temple of God, in essence, come in and... Not that they could actually... I mean, nobody could come and take the work of God in my heart away, but they could come into a group of people and cause problems and sow discord and teach people foolish things that aren't true and convince some people to believe it and get factions going and essentially make the place so that it's no longer a group of people proclaiming the gospel and trying to live it out, but it's this group committed to all kinds of weird stuff, and yes, there are still believers who are destined for the kingdom of God among them, but many of them may stop coming because it's no longer a place where the gospel is really being proclaimed, and in the end, the place has fallen apart. It's not really the temple of God anymore. I think that's what he's getting at. So I think it's important for us in each place to see what is his temple picture and what is he doing with it. What I was saying in this one, the idea is this is the place where God is at work among us. Later on, when he talks about how I use my body, how I conduct myself sexually, now the question is, what sort of a thing is my body? And rather than the idea that my body, which this is a Greek idea that some Greeks would have had, that evidently some of the Corinthians are buying the idea that somehow it doesn't matter what I do with my body. My body is kind of disposable. His argument is, no, the body is for the Lord. The body is the place in which the Spirit of God is at work. The body is me. The God body is the place where I am working out my salvation. So I can't treat my body like it's just, I can do whatever I want with it, and meanwhile my spirit will be all spiritual. No, my body is a temple of God. God is at work in this, so I can't just treat it as if it doesn't matter, because it does matter. Two very different issues in the two passages, and so using the picture of a temple in two different ways, I think. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Does that answer your question?
I'd be right then. I just really first, got a picture of this for the first time. Would you agree with me then that the works being burnt up in 1 Corinthians 3 and the temple being destroyed in 1 Corinthians 4 is the same metaphor?
That's an interesting question.
Because if it is, in 1 Corinthians 3, the man is saved. In 1 Corinthians 4, the one who destroys the temple of God, God will destroy it. And since they seem to be both talking about the same thing.
Yeah, I think I'm understanding them differently. Because in one, the picture is a picture of some sort of judgment, either the day of judgment ultimately, or it could be, he says, the day will show it. It's also quite possible, you know, we recognize that in a community of people, things can come along that basically test what the group is all about.
The way that I've taken that.
Yeah. So here, the picture might be of Apollos who has been working among them, and then something comes along and shows that basically, you know, this is not what he thought it was. So it didn't survive the fire. Whereas in the other picture, though, I'm picturing not Apollos, but somebody else who actually is seeking to make it the kind of place that wouldn't survive the fire. I mean, they're seeking to undo what Paul had done. They actually are... Their goal is to undo it. Apollos is not seeking to do that. He just didn't get it right. Whereas some of them actually would say, yeah, I see what Paul's saying, and we want something different.
Sometimes it's impossible to not do it. I remember going to John MacArthur's church for years, and that's where I basically grew up.
Right.
And there is nothing that he does to exalt himself. And yet, if there was any place in the world I could take somebody and show them people, that will say, well, I'm of John MacArthur.
Right.
You know,
right.
You know, that's where it is. You know?
Right. Right. Yeah. Well, it can happen. You're right. And I think because Apollos and Paul are together at the end of the letter, and in another letter, Paul speaks well of Apollos, so this is a number of years later. I don't think that the picture is one of Apollos actually seeking to cause this kind of trouble, but he seems to have contributed to it. And that's the... I can understand that.
Maybe that's why Paul says be careful.
Yeah, right. Well, I think we're going to wrap it up for tonight. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.